This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Jimmy Creech assumed that everyone he knew was a heterosexual, just like he was, until one day in 1984. That's when he met a man named Adam. Adam came to him in tears and revealed that he was gay. In fact, he had known Adam for a while, but that revelation was new. Jimmy was an ordained United Methodist minister, Adam a parishioner in the church that Jimmy led in Warsaw, North Carolina. It's a small town in the eastern part of the state. Adam, which is a pseudonym that Jimmy gave him, was angry and hurt that the governing body of the church had voted to forbid self-avowed practicing homosexuals from becoming ordained ministers. Adam's revelation moved Jimmy to take up his cause, and he began to advocate from the pulpit and in the community for the rights of homosexuals within the United Methodist Church. Eventually, his advocacy cost him his ordination. Jimmy Creech recalls his journey from minister to activist in a new book, Adam's Gift, a memoir from a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. And Jimmy Creech joins me now. Welcome to the program. It's good to
have you. Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Tell me about the day that Adam came to see you. You'd known him. He was a parishioner in your church. It's 1984. You had read that morning in the paper about the National Methodist Church's ruling. Let's go back to that. What was your reaction to that ruling when you read it?
I read the paper. I'd read on the days preceding that other reports of actions taken by the General Conference of the United Methodist Church, and back basically was pretty indifferent to them. I didn't think anything was happening in Baltimore, where it was meeting, that would impact my ministry. And when I read that morning that, this is the language the church uses, self-avowed practicing homosexuals would not be ordained or appointed in our church, I didn't think anything of it. I didn't know anybody who was self-avowed practicing homosexual. So it basically was just a bit of news that just sort of passed before my eyes and then was forgotten.
And then Adam walks in and he has to talk to you.
Adam walks in with great pain and in tears and just pours his heart and soul out to me. He comes out to me, and the reason I do not identify him is because he was unable to come out publicly. He was a professional in the community, someone who was highly respected, but he knew that if he came out, he would lose his job. He would lose his career. He was also very active in the church. I'd known him for 3 years. He liked my sermon, so I thought he was a very intelligent person. And he was just a very wonderful person. What he did for me that morning was destroy all the stereotypes I had about gay people. And, you know, I had pretty much the conventional mindset that to be gay or queer or homosexual was some kind of abnormality, some kind of perversion. It was a sickness. You know, it just wasn't a healthy reality. Adam was a very healthy person of character, someone who cared for the community, worked worked for the church, very active supporter. He was a kind, gentle person of faith. All of the stereotypes simply just were destroyed in his presence. And so I found myself conflicted in the sense that my attitudes and opinions I could no longer hold, and I had to do something about that.
It's interesting about Adam, though. I mean, here's a man, as you said, he had a career. He's in his 40s.
He's in his late 40s.
He's active in the church. He is not an avowed practicing homosexual because he's not out. He's still in the closet. Mm-hmm. Why did this rule? I mean, he'd had a life, and he knew how to navigate the system mm-hmm. without ever having to declare his sexual preference. Why does a ruling like this bother him?
It was for him the last straw. He told me about what it was like as a child, discovering his sexuality and realizing that it was not what people expected of him and not what people would accept if they knew. He knew no one else who was gay, and of course that was language he didn't know as a child, but he knew no one else like him, no one to talk to. He was afraid of talking to his parents. He certainly wasn't going to talk to teachers or preachers or Sunday school teachers. He just felt extremely isolated. On one hand, he heard from those in the church talking about God's unconditional love for everyone. There's nothing that can cause God not to love you. And then on the other hand, he heard the message that if you're queer, you're going to hell and there was no hope for you. And he found himself caught between these irreconcilable messages, unable to really know what to do. And for a long time, he was very angry, very shameful about who he was and how he felt about men, young and about boys when he was a boy. Angry with God because he felt like in some way he was cursed. He even considered suicide because he thought maybe that was the way to escape his homosexuality and also show true repentance. But ultimately, he came down on the side of God's love and decided that he would trust that love, even though the message of the church was contrary to it. So he grew up active in the church. He was committed to the church. There were other things that had been done in the church. But that day, with this proclamation, the church was saying that people like him were not welcome. He didn't want to be ordained, but he was in a group that was set aside as unacceptable, as morally inferior, and he wouldn't take it any longer. And I told him that day, I don't remember many things that I said to him that day because I was overwhelmed. I told him, Adam, I support your decision to leave because no one should be and remain in an abusive relationship. I don't want you to leave this congregation. I really hate to see you leave, but I understand your pain and I don't want you to continue in a situation where you feel abused. I told him that I would be his pastor as long as he wanted me to be, even if he were not an official member of the church. And I assured him of God's love.
That's what you told him. What were you telling yourself?
Well, I was actually listening to my words, and I realized that what I was saying to him was not something that I would have said in a sort of abstract way. If I did not have Adam sitting before me, if I were just talking in general about people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, I would have not had those words to say and the feelings behind them, the conviction behind them. It was his presence. It was his reality, his humanity that drew those words out of my soul. And I was convinced of what I said. And so I went from that moment when he left my office to find out why it was the church had the position it did about homosexuality and homosexuals. And so I did extensive biblical research, research into human sexuality and church history. And after a year or two, it was my clear conviction that the Bible says nothing about homosexuality, that sexual orientation, which was really discovered in the late 1800s, as an innate, essential part of every human being, and it's normal, natural, and healthy, whether it's heterosexual, bisexual, or homosexual, and that the church was wrong in its persecution of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and I had a responsibility to challenge it.
You know, these writings and teachings have been around for a long, long time, and the Methodist Church has been around for a while. Why was it in 1984 that the church decided to lay down this particular dictum?
Well, the church was reacting to movement within society toward more open acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. So it was a reaction by the church to progress being made in society, which is often the way the church behaves. The first sort of restrictive language the church incorporated in its Book of Discipline was in 1972 when it said that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Sort of a almost innocuous sounding statement, but it's equivalent to saying that homosexuality is a sin. And the consequences of that innocuous language are no less painful than to hear someone say homosexuality is a sin or to say God hates fags. I mean, it's just as bad. So this language in 1984 was built upon that language of incompatibility or the language of sin. Later, another rule would be added, and that would be to prohibit clergy from celebrating what the church calls homosexual unions. So it was regressively moving toward more and more restrictive language in our laws that exclude gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender
people.
It's
a paradox in churches, and we'll stick with Christian churches for the moment because that's what we're talking about, mm-hmm. that they at once claim that their teaching comes from ancient sources, but they do seem to move, and their actions and changes seem to correlate with the times.
Yes, and there's a history of how religion has been misused to justify social prejudice. It was used to justify slavery. I mean, you look at all the religious writings from the 1700s and 1800s in the South particularly, and they all justify and support slavery. Racial segregation was supported. I grew up in a rigid, racially segregated society. I was taught that it's God's will for the races to be separate, that the Bible says so. I heard that from my most respected adult leaders. So there's a history. Women have also been impacted in that way. But once society moves beyond that, we begin to look back at these archaic religious teachings and say, well, those were wrong. We are wrong on that. We have got to make the same kind of move away from those teachings that do harm to gay people.
We'll find out how you came to your theology and ministry when the state of things continues. Today we're talking with Jimmy Creech, an advocate for gay and lesbian rights, the author of Adam's Gift, a memoir of a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. We'll continue the conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest today is Jimmy Creech, author of Adam's Gift, a memoir of a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. Did you grow up in the Methodist Church?
I did. I almost feel like I was born in it. It was my second home as a child in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Loved going to church. It was just the place to be. I recall those years as very important ones. I learned then that what God really wants us to do is to make the world a better place. The emphasis was on the golden rule, the story of the Good Samaritan, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Those are the kinds of teachings I remember.
Did you always want to be a minister?
No, I was scared to death of speaking in public. when I had to speak in public, my body began to shake and my mind went blank. So being a preacher was not something I looked forward to. But I had an experience as a young, as 17-year-old that really I felt was compelling that led me into ministry.
What was that?
I was working with a summer youth program sponsored by the United Methodist Church on the coast of North Carolina, actually in Carteret County, with migrant farm workers in 1962. I had been there for a week or two working in a child care center, sorting clothing that had been donated to the migrants, looking at going with volunteer dentists and doctors to do medical work in the migrant camps. And then on the Sunday morning, I went with an African-American minister to one of the camps to do worship. And I just had a wonderful feeling about how nice it was to be there with the workers and share some positive, encouraging words. And immediately following the service, a very thin, very strong black man came right up to my face with a young boy in front of him, his hands on the young boy's shoulders. And he looked into my eyes and he said, with deep serious earnestness, sincerity, "Save my son from having to live this life." And I realized in that moment, even though I didn't know how to respond, but I realized that all those pretty words, all those nice, religious words didn't mean anything without action, without really living the message, without really doing what needed to be done. And so I felt very much called, reflecting on that, to really be involved in a ministry of action, and later more clearly defined it as doing social justice work, and which I understand to be spiritual justice as well.
You did your undergrad at UNC, and then you went to Duke Divinity School.
That's correct.
And that was in the late 1960s?
I finished at UNC in 67, finished at Duke in 70.
What was it like there, Duke, at the Divinity School?
Well, it was a wonderful time. Actually, I shouldn't say that in that way. It was wonderful in terms of my education and my maturation. It was a devastating period of history in America. The Vietnam War was at its height. Dr. King was assassinated my first year as a student. And Bobby Kennedy was assassinated not long after. The Cambodia was bombed. The Kent State massacre took place. There was just a tremendous amount of horrific things happening. But all of those things shaped my understanding of what God was calling me to do and what God was calling the church to do, and really set me on a course of engagement with injustices.
What was happening at the Divinity School? Was there tension, robust debate about the place of the church, the role of the minister in this, or had it become a kind of a progressive place? Had liberation theology, and we can ask you to talk about that, taken root at the Divinity School, or was it debate?
It was actually Fred Herzog was my primary professor at Duke Divinity School, and Fred was first of all captivated by the work of Jürgen Moltmann, who was a German theologian who wrote the Theology of Hope, which is a sort of a precursor to liberation theology. It lays a foundation for it. But Fred also was very interested in black theology by Kuhn in this country, by theology being written in South Africa and in Latin America. And all of these really were very informative. They really helped helped me to understand what the priorities are in the Christian gospel and Christian ministry. And what we really are about, whether we are here to undergird and protect the status quo, or whether we are really called to challenge the status quo and to end injustice. And it's the ending of injustice and the challenging of status quo that I feel clearly was the call of Jesus and the call of the ministry that I'm a part of.
And, of course, all of the things you named as important on the social agenda at that time did not include what we now call as gay rights. Was there much talk about homosexuality and its place in both society and the church?
No, there was none. In fact, actually, the role of women in the church and society was just beginning to be talked about at that time. Some of my classmates I've later come to know as lesbian and gay. But that was not a topic of discussion. Of course, that was actually before, in regard to the United Methodist Church, the first language placed in our discipline, which was 72. That happened after I left Duke. So there was no conversation at all about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and the need for the church to be affirming them and working in society to gain them full and equal rights.
So you became a minister. You find yourself now, we'll bring you fast forward and back to 1984, when the Methodist Church bans openly gay people from becoming ministers. You meet Adam, and your career, your mind takes this turn. What happened after that? Where did you go?
I went to Raleigh in 1987, 3 years later, and went with a tremendous amount of excitement. The Fairmont United Methodist Church is right on the edge of North Carolina State University. Wonderful congregation. And was actually, when I arrived, very involved in opposing the Contra War in Nicaragua, very involved in working on homeless issues. Still not yet in any kind of intentional or organized way dealing with issues related to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the church and society. But I began to meet some clergy who shared my concern about wanting to do something. And so together in the fall of 1987, we created an organization called Raleigh Religious Network for Gay and Lesbian Equality, and began with an understanding that we could not support gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people in the privacy of our office and then allow them to go out into a world that is hostile and harmful to them, that we needed to address very publicly the structures of injustice that do them harm. And so we began to do some educational work, annual conferences, speakers bureau, just became very active in public.
And eventually this got you in trouble.
Well, you know, I was really not doing anything particularly within the church, within the congregation of Fairmont, but because of my public activity outside, there were members of the congregation who were not happy with that and began to put pressure on the leadership of the church to have me removed, both the leadership of the congregation and the leadership of the conference, the bishop and the district superintendent. But the majority of the members and the late leadership of Fairmont United Methodist Church remained very supportive, and I was able to remain there for 3 years. But at the end of 3 years, because the church was almost financially in a position of having to close the doors because of the resistance and unhappiness with my ministry, it was found to be necessary for me to leave.
And then that led you to Omaha, Nebraska.
Well, in between, I worked with the North Carolina Council of Churches for 6.5 years, which is a wonderful organization. I was told by the bishop in North Carolina that there would not be another church for me to be pastor to, that because of my advocacy, I had basically made myself unappointable.
Let me stop you there. Yeah. That, I assume, was a conversation. You didn't leave it at that. You pushed back and you said, no doubt, look, here's what the book says. Let me open it up and show you the gospel. And how does the church hierarchy defend an advocate for the marginal, marginalizing, moving out of a position of authority, an advocate for those who are marginalized?
Well, it really wasn't that nice and clean. Yeah, I think you, in many ways, have given some credit to the church that it doesn't deserve. It was pretty much politics. I was unpopular. I had become very hot, very much a pariah within the North Carolina Annual Conference. Even very close friends felt they could not identify with me and support me.
Well, I'm gonna interrupt one more time. Forgive me. Mm-hmm. So, it's something like, Jimmy, we support you. We know it's what Jesus would have done. But you know what? It's just becoming trouble. And people are turning away and the money's going down. It's not because of what you're doing. It's just the effect that it's having. Sorry, we got to say goodbye. Something like that.
I think that's a perfect summary of it. I was actually told by District Superintendent, Jimmy, we're not upset with you because you advocate for gay people. It's because you do it publicly. And because you do it publicly, we can't support you.
I'm sorry. So now, then you have to. There has to be this argument. Well, you know, the ministry of Jesus was notoriously public. It's what got him to the cross.
And unpopular.
Highly unpopular. Does the church blush when you point out the absolute irony of saying that doing what's unpopular was precisely what the founder of this church did? It got him killed.
I think there is a certain embarrassment the church feels, but at the same time there is this expediency and pragmatism that the church sort of deals with. They want to be sure they don't lose money. They don't want to lose members. The institution becomes the most important thing to protect, and individuals are expendable.
So tell us now how you did come. They were not going to give you another church, but you came to pastor church in Omaha.
Well, I got a call in 1996, March of 1996, from a district superintendent in Omaha, Nebraska, asking if I would be willing to consider being the senior pastor at First United Methodist Church in Omaha, Nebraska. Came completely out of the blue. I thought perhaps I was being delusional because I never expected that. Mm-hmm. I hadn't sought it. I knew nothing about Nebraska except that's where corn comes from and football. I explored that with the district superintendent. I talked with my wife about it. She actually was from the Midwest and came to North Carolina to get her master's degree in social work at UNC, but also to get away from the bad winters, and didn't want to go back to bad winters. So she had some reluctance, and our daughter was in a wonderful situation in school here and didn't want to give that up. But we considered it, and we went and we talked to folks, and they said, okay, we would like for you to come. And so in 96, in June of 96, my wife, my daughter, and I moved to Omaha, Nebraska.
And it was there that you performed your first same-sex ceremony, union.
That's right. And actually, the district superintendent, when I asked, why me, you know, why, sort of like a needle in a haystack that you found here, why did you call me? And she said, because of your history in advocating for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. And so there was the implied support and affirmation of that ministry. I mean, otherwise, why would she call? I was very open with her about my history. She knew everything about it. So did the bishop. And I also told them that I would not abide by the recent ruling or recent decision of the General Conference to prohibit clergy from celebrating holy unions of same-gender couples. I have been doing that since 1990. I had done maybe a dozen, and I thought to agree to that legislation or that language would be to be complicit in the persecution of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, and I was not going to do that. It would also mean I would be repudiating the relationships I'd celebrated in the past and denying those couples who came to me in the future the opportunity to celebrate and honor their relationship. So they knew that I would continue to do the ceremonies before I left North Carolina.
Tell us about the first one that you did and what that was like for you. Now, this the first union that you would have celebrated predated the ban against them, so it wasn't a violation of any church rule.
That's right.
But it was certainly a unique experience for you, I would
say. It was wonderful. I was at Fairmont. It was my last spring in Fairmont. The couple had begun to come to Fairmont because of some publicity about my ministry, and they came to be supportive. They then said to me, you know, we've been together for 10 years or more, we really would like to have a wedding. And I said I'd be very honored. You can't affirm an individual gay person without affirming relationships. I mean, relationships are a very important part of who we are as individuals. So to say, you know, I can affirm you as an individual, but I can't affirm the two of you as a couple would be absolutely wrong. So I was delighted, and we actually had the ceremony in the backyard of their home, beautiful backyard that one of the men had landscaped. It was a traditional service, Christian service, with the Eucharist or Holy Communion. Their friends and family were there. It was just a very wonderful occasion and one of the highlights of my life.
Now you're going to go to Omaha. You're mm-hmm. obviously going to be part of a church that likes your reputation as an advocate, and you tell them, but I won't abide by this. What was their reaction to that?
The reaction from the district superintendent when I explained that I would not abide by the law was, well, we'll walk that road together when the time comes. It was not any kind of real firm commitment, but at least it was not saying, well, we don't want you or you can't do that or anything like that. It was sort of like, okay, well, maybe that's just sort of an abstract idea right now, but when it becomes real, we'll talk about it.
And it became real.
And it became very real. In 1997, I did a wedding, a covenant ceremony for two women who were members of the congregation. I let the bishop know several months in advance at his request. He wanted me to let him know if I ever agreed to celebrate a covenant ceremony. He did not tell me not to do it. He did, until 2 weeks before the ceremony, he called and said, Jimmy, I know you're going to do it, but I, as a bishop, have to tell you not to. But if you're going to do it, could you have it rescheduled, because I'm supposed to be out of the country when it's to happen. He was going to be on study leave in Spain and needed to be. He wanted to be around in case there was any publicity. But what he most feared was publicity. He was not going to tell me not to do it at that particular point in time. But it was when the publicity really brought it, made a controversy out of it, that he then began to be very punitive.
Did you have any reservations about that one? I mean, did you have fully in mind what the consequences might be if you went ahead?
No, I did not have fully in mind what the consequences might be. Considering the consequences, I thought was irrelevant. What was relevant, what was important, was the relationship of these two people, their love for one another, their desire to create a family together. That was what was important, and my role as their pastor. If there were consequences, that was in somebody else's hands, not mine. And so I was not going to make a decision in regard to them, to the couple, based on my fear or anticipation or apprehension of what might happen, what someone else might do.
There was publicity, and you were eventually tried,
put on trial. A complaint after the covenant ceremony was filed against me and the United Methodist Church. That initiates a judicial process. The complaint is then looked at by a committee of investigation, which is like a grand jury. They determined that, yes, there was a basis for the complaint, and then it became a charge against me, and I was placed on trial in 1998. I was actually acquitted in the trial. The United Methodist Church has 13 jurors participating in a trial, and it requires 9 guilty votes, and there were 8 guilty votes and 5 not guilty. And the reason for that was we convinced the jury that this language was not actually a law in the church. It was placed in what we call our social principles, which have historically been understood to be advisory and persuasive, not legal. And even though this language says that clergy shall not, it still was in the principles. And so 8 of the jury, fortunately, understood this to be advisory.
There was another trial. Things turned out differently. And we'll get into that and talk more this hour with my guest, Jimmy Creech, the author of Adam's Gift, a memoir of a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. Our conversation continues on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Jimmy Creech. He's an advocate for gay and lesbian rights. He's the author of the new book, Adam's Gift, a memoir of a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. It is something that you did successfully, at least in the court, the Methodist court, in Omaha, Nebraska, but it did leave you once again without a church.
After the acquittal in that first trial, the bishop would not allow me to remain at First United Methodist Church, in spite of the fact the congregation was extremely supportive and very heartbroken that I could not remain. The congregation had just been wonderful for the period of time that I was there and continues today to advocate for full and equal acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the church and in society. It's a wonderful congregation. But because I would not promise not to do covenant ceremonies in the future because I had given him too many headaches already, he simply just denied me that opportunity. So my family and I came back to North Carolina in June of 1998.
And then you performed another ceremony in 99.
In the fall of 98, I spoke at Community United Church of Christ in Chapel Hill, and there met Larry Ellis and Jim Raymer. And soon after, they asked if I would join with Jill Edens, the pastor of Community United Church of Christ, to share in their wedding that they were planning for April of 1999. And I agreed to do that. Now, I must let you know that between my first trial and this second wedding, in fact, it was in August of 1998, the Judicial Council of the United Methodist Church made a declaratory ruling that in spite of the fact this one little phrase prohibiting clergy from celebrating homosexual unions that had been placed in our social principles, declaring that one phrase to be law and all the rest of the social principles advisory.
Wow.
So
couldn't they just lift it out and made it a law? They can do whatever they want.
They did that at the next general conference.
Oh, I see.
But
I see.
This was sort of like an intermediate step for them. But they wanted to be sure that clergy understood that they would be legally liable to prosecution if they violated this rule. So I knew that when I accepted the invitation. But after my first trial, I had actually sent out a call to all clergy in the United Methodist Church to defy this law. And I was saying to them, if everyone defies this law, the church cannot prosecute us all. There were some who actually did that, not because I suggested it, but because they also thought it was the right thing to do. But in 99, when I conducted the wedding or assisted Jill Edens in conducting the wedding in in Chapel Hill. Again, complaints were brought against me. They were found to be justified. A charge was made against me, and a trial took place in November of 1999. Because I was clear that, I mean, there was no question of the ambiguity of this language. It was law. I decided to approach this trial as sort of an act of nonviolent resistance. I said that I would not have church counsel. I would not have a defense lawyer, which would have to be a minister. I would not enter a plea. I would not help with the jury selection because I didn't want to be responsible for anyone being complicit in what I considered to be an act of violence, not against me, but against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. And that all I would do, and that I would answer the questions of the prosecuting clergy, but the only additional thing I would do would be to make a statement to the jury. And in that statement, I clearly said that this law is corrupt, it's an act of injustice, it's an act of bigotry against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and I ask you not to acquit me and not to find me guilty, but simply refuse to vote. I wanted them to, what I said, rise above the law and do the right thing, you know, and say, protest this law. I was found guilty by unanimous vote of all 13 jurors.
What was that like for you?
It was devastating.
We should explain what that meant.
That meant, well, that was the guilty verdict. And then they went into a session to decide on the penalty. And the penalty was that they would remove my credentials of ordination, which had been given to me in 1970.
You're no longer a minister.
So I'm no longer clergy. I'm no longer ordained minister. And in the United Methodist Church, clergy belong to annual conferences. They don't belong to local churches. So in order to belong to an annual conference as a clergy person, you must be ordained. So I was consequently no longer United Methodist, and I had to join a local congregation in order to be United Methodist, which I did, so that I could continue the effort to help the church, what I understand the church to help it regain its integrity with the gospel.
But again, in, you know, getting back to your reaction to that, now that we know what was at stake, you lost your ministry.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really lose my ministry. I lost my ordination. Mm-hmm. I felt like in many ways my ministry was even more precise and defined for me. I knew that I had a calling. I knew that I had a responsibility. I was accountable to what had happened. I couldn't just let it go and say, poor me. I had to continue to confront the church and let it see its own bigotry and its own prejudice.
But did it matter to you that you lost your ordination?
It did. One of the wonderful experiences I had was came home in tremendous grief, and I had really contained that grief. I just needed time alone and some quiet in order to really work through the grief. And immediately got home, and there was a message on our answering machine at home from a friend who was lesbian, who said that her sister was critically ill in the ICU at Rex Hospital. Would I please come and visit her? Now, Judith knew that I had just had my credentials taken from me. I was no longer a minister, but she was asking me to go and visit her sister. So I politely said to Judith, I'll be glad to go. And I hung up the phone and I said, damn it, she doesn't understand. So then I go to the hospital. I visit with the sister who's in a coma, all these tubes hooked up to her, you know, close to death. I hold her hand. I pray with her. I kiss her forehead, and I leave, and I realize, you know, they took my credentials, but I still know who I am. I still know what my ministry is. So it was like a revelation to me, actually, to have this opportunity to be a pastor, even though I was not ordained. And it really kind of helped me put into perspective what had happened. The church had taken away from me something it had given, and it had every right to take away from me. But it had not taken away my baptism. It had not taken away my calling to ministry, and I was going to continue.
It raises the question, though, of the relevance of the church. If people like you feel that way, you have a calling. Churches are political organizations that won't argue the theology, but only the consequences. Mm-hmm. why stay a member of the church? Why not just practice your ministry outside of that?
Well, it's a peculiar thing. As I said earlier, I grew up at St. Paul United Methodist Church in Goldsboro, and I learned these lessons, these stories about Jesus and about Moses and David and the prophets and Paul, you know, all of these wonderful stories, and they shaped my mind and they shaped my heart. I also suggested earlier that this was a racist, originally segregated racist society, and those very people who taught me those messages were the very ones who defended the segregation when the civil rights movement began. And so the irony is that these messages came through people who were very racist, very angry when people of color wanted their equal and rights, civil rights. The church really, in all of its frailty, in all of its often incompetence and all of its weaknesses, still carries an important message. And I feel a responsibility to help carry that message, whether it's perfectly carried or not, and by myself or by anyone else. The message still is a very important and empowering one. It has been extremely important in empowering people in Latin America and South Africa, African Americans in this country. There is a tremendous amount of power behind these messages of liberation and love and compassion. And I'm committed to that message. The church is an institution that just sort of like is a necessary organization that somehow has to be in place for this to happen. It just can't. I guess we've learned over the years we got to have an organization. But within every institution, there are these movements of resistance to help reform, to bring about more integrity, to bring about clarity of mission. And that's what I want to be a part of. I care about the church in that regard.
So tell us about your work now, because you're still working through the church.
I am still working through the church in various ways. I have been a part of Soul Force, which is an organization that Mel White created back in 1998. Using the principles of nonviolent resistance that Gandhi developed and Martin Luther King used in this country to bring about liberation for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people within the religious context. In 2005, I began work with Mitchell Gold, who is co-owner of Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, the furniture manufacturer here in North Carolina. Together, we created an organization called Faith in America, and its purpose was to use media tactics and campaigns to educate people about the history of religion-based bigotry in this country as it applies to women, people of color, Native Americans, religious minorities, and gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. Most recently, I'm working with Kevin Rogers, who is the founder of the North Carolina Social Justice Project, and I'm on chair of the board of the board of directors for the organization, and we are working on a variety of issues dealing with poverty and other issues that are important ones.
Are the churches becoming split along these ideological lines? In other words, do you simply become a congregation of the willing and no longer have this dialogue? Everybody is maybe making the case, working toward a kind of social justice through that organization, but everybody in the church is kind of going along. Do you see more and more of that happening, or are churches really grappling with this to maintain their integrity but still have the argument within their church?
The movement in the churches, I think, is a progressive one. I think there is positive change taking place. The Lutherans recently have done some wonderful work. They pass legislation. And it really does sound interesting to talk about churches passing legislation. It sounds like it's sort of an irreconcilable difference here. You know, the churches do act as a political body often. And so they did pass legislation to allow openly gay, lesbian, bisexual clergy to serve when they are in committed relationships. That's been a very major step. The Presbyterians have had very good conversations on the national level, but just haven't yet gotten down to the local level yet. The United Church of Christ has been way out ahead of us on these issues. Recent polls indicate that Roman Catholics have a higher percentage of support for full and equal rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people than any other Christian group or denomination, which was a wonderful bit of news. The United Methodists at this point are going in just the opposite direction. They really are digging in their heels and becoming more entrenched in the anti-gay persecution in the church. And so that's unfortunate. And it's really unfortunate because of the tradition that we have that comes from John Wesley that really sought to bring about social good, sought to end social injustice. And so it's a shame in that regard.
Is North Carolina, do you think, a more progressive place when it comes to gay and lesbian rights than it was in 1984?
It absolutely is more progressive, more open and affirming and accepting. And, of course, we have had tremendous demographic changes in North Carolina. But I credit the change, and in every context, I credit the change to those lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people who have had the integrity and the sense of dignity and the courage to let it be known who they are and to not be ashamed to live life openly. They don't really have to do a whole lot more than just to be honest about their loving relationships. Those are the people that are destroying the stereotypes that have held the persecution in place.
And in many cases, when they decide to stay in the church, because it'd be real easy to leave mm-hmm. and create your own denomination, some of that has happened, but to stay in the church and say, I do belong here,
yes.
and this is my way of life, now we will all have to deal with it. What kind of impact has that had?
That is what's bringing about the change. And we're seeing the atmosphere and the being more and more permissive of gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people being out and open. On the national level, just, you know, celebrities who are out have really helped a great deal. But on the local level also, I mean, we have teachers who are out, preachers who are out, doctors who are out. I mean, your local grocery store person. In every walk of life, more and more lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are coming out, being who they are, claiming their right to be a part of this society, of this church, of this country. And that's what is bringing about the change.
And now tell us what's happened to Adam.
Adam. Well, in 1990, there was an article in the News and Observer about my ministry with gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people and the controversy around it. And the effort in at Fairmont Church to have me removed. He called me the night that was in the paper, and again he was in tears because he felt responsible for getting me into this trouble. And so he apologized. He said, Jimmy, I'm sorry I've done this. I'm sorry I got you into this trouble. And of course he didn't. And I said, Adam, you don't need to apologize. You gave me a gift. You told me the truth about who you are. You shared with me, entrusted me with this reality about who you are, and helped me to see a persecution and injustice in the church that the church was responsible for that I had not seen before. So you gave me a gift. And he said, well, you know, when I'm able to retire, I'm going to be a social activist for gay and lesbian equality. I'm going to dedicate my life to making the world a safe and better place for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. 2 years later, he died of a heart attack before he was able to retire, before he was able to realize that dream. But he changed my life, and so I think of him often in the work that I do as the one who gave me the opportunity.
Jimmy Creech, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
The book is Adam's Gift, a memoir of a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. Jimmy Creech is going to speak and sign copies of the book at NOFO The Pig in Raleigh on Saturday, April 23rd, the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on April 25th, Internationalist Bookstore in Chapel Hill on Wednesday, April 27th. For more information about the book and upcoming events, Jimmy Creech's Facebook page is Creech, spelled C-R-E-E-C-H. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.